Good afternoon to everyone who is joining us at the moment. I'm going to give it another minute or two just to let people give them a chance to get logged on as the university just reopened at noon, due to our lovely storm. Hopefully everyone had a chance to enjoy some of it, either outside or sitting inside looking at it, smiling and waving at the snow as it fell.
Thank you for the reminder this morning.
Yes. Kyle, how's it looking down in New York City?
I'm actually in Ithaca. Isn't that crazy? So
What?
we came to snowboard, and so we're going tonight to Greek Peak, and I'm like, bless.
Wow, you picked a good weekend to come and snowboard, huh?
Yeah, the cabin we're staying in did lose power until just now, though. So it's like, there's pros and cons.
There you go. Perfect timing. I'm going to give it one more minute for people to get on and join us again with the university just reopening at noon. Give people a chance to get settled in and join us. Okay, I am calling the special meeting of the Employee Assembly to order at 12:03 p.m. on Monday, January 26th, 2026. As this is a special meeting, we will not be doing roll call as attendance is not mandatory for this. However, I will read the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayakono, the Cuga Nation. The Gayakono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayakono disposition and honor the ongoing connection of Gayakono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. I am happy to have or introduce Stephanie Baldwin and Nicholas Brennan. They are both members of this of the Code and Procedures Review Committee. Nicholas Brennan is a PhD candidate in physics and also the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly president. And Stephanie Baldwin is the Robert G. Engle Director of Sorority and Fraternity Life. Stephanie and Robert, I will turn this over to you. Once we get to the Q&A section, though, I will mount, I can help facilitate the speaker list and anything like that. So it's all yours. I believe we have the option set up if you need to do any screen sharing. It is now. So yeah, it's all you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And on behalf of Nicholas and I, we are so grateful for your time. Like Wendy had mentioned, we're just hitting the ground running this morning. So we appreciate your time as we move through this process. So we have a little bit of a script that we're going to share with you as we're trying to keep all of our listening sessions consistent. So we're going to share a video. And hopefully, Nick, on your end, you're able to share it. I'm having some trouble with my Zoom this morning. It's not loving when I try to share things. But we will get that up and running, and then we're going to leave a lot of space open for your feedback and questions and comments. And so we'll open it up with a little script that we have. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Stephanie Baldwin, and I'm the Director of Sorority and Fraternity Life and also a member of this Code Revisions Committee. And I'm a member, oh, yeah, of the Code Procedures Review Committee. I am joined with my colleague and fellow committee member who will introduce himself now.
Hi everyone. My name is Nicholas Brennan. I'm a third-year PhD student in the Department of Physics, and I'm the current president of the Graduate Professional Student Assembly. Today, we're really grateful for you to have taken the time to be here with us to share your thoughts. And as members of the Code and Procedures Review Committee, we want to begin by sharing a bit about our role.
The Code and Procedures Review Committee was convened to gather feedback and make recommendations regarding the content and structure of the Student Code of Conduct and its associated procedures. We are a non-voting committee, which means our role is to listen, gather input, and share the feedback with the committee regarding proposed revisions to the Code and Student Code of Conduct and procedures.
It's important to note that this session is not about discussing who holds authority over the code or its procedures. That topic is outside the scope of our charge. We're here to focus on recommendations for improvement to the current code and procedures themselves.
Additionally, if you have feedback related to individuals who work in the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, OSCCS, we kindly ask that you direct that feedback to the Dean of Students, Marla Love. This session is not, excuse me, not an appropriate space for personnel-related concerns.
Now, for a bit about how we will run today's session, we'll begin with an 11-minute video that provides an overview of the current student code of conduct and procedures. After the video, we will have 50 minutes, that's 5-0 minutes, for suggestions and feedback from you all.
During the session, our role is to listen and to document your feedback. We won't be responding to questions or debating points. Instead, we are here to ensure your voices are heard and your suggestions are brought back to the committee for consideration. We will take notes, and I believe a transcript is also being provided to the committee.
And with that, we will now begin the video presentation. Afterward, we will open the floor for your feedback. Thank you again all for being here, and we look forward to engaging in this important process. So I have the video, but Jessica, I'm not sure if you also had it.
I have it. This is my first time. Usually Eric does this part, so let me give it a shot. Would you mind, Nick?
That'd be perfect. Thank you, Jessica.
I can also do it, Jessica, if you like.
Oh, Eric's there. Sure.
One moment, I'll go ahead. Yep, so I have it. We'll get started in one second.
This video provides a general overview of the 2020 Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures at Cornell University. Let's start by clarifying what we mean by the Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures. The Student Code of Conduct, or the code for short, defines prohibited student behavior. This includes, but is not limited to, conduct such as underage alcohol consumption, theft of property, or engaging in hazing. The code applies to all students and student organizations when conduct occurs on campus or on property used for educational purposes. It also applies to student conduct involving university computing and networking resources from remote locations, online behavior, or any conduct that threatens the university's educational mission or the safety of individuals. You can find the current 2020 Code of Conduct online by scanning the QR code on your screen. Some community conduct is not covered by the code. For example, faculty and staff conduct does not fall under the current code, nor does conduct of Weill Cornell students and students that are not degree seeking. Additionally, some student conduct is covered by alternative processes. Conduct related to academic integrity is addressed through the Code of Academic Integrity. Sexual and related misconduct is addressed through the Cornell Office of Civil Rights. And conduct specific to athletic teams covered by the NCAA is addressed directly through athletics. The procedures, on the other hand, refer to the step-by-step process to resolve a conduct case. The procedures identify the various ways that a case can be resolved to reach a final outcome. The various pathways a case can be resolved will be shared later in this video. You can view the current 2020 procedures using the QR code provided. Together, the code and the procedures establish behavioral expectations and articulate the process to uphold community standards and ensure a safe, fair, and educational environment for all of the campus community. Both the code and the procedures are eligible to be reviewed annually to ensure each remains relevant and effective. The process to do so is outlined in the code. The code and the procedures are administered by the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, a department within the Office of the Dean of Students in the Division of Student and Campus Life. This office was created in 2020 to administer the current code and procedures through an educational and restorative student experience that uphold community standards while promoting personal development. The office engages in prevention education and strives to support students navigating conflict in a transparent, fair, and equitable process. Let's now turn to a high-level overview of Cornell's student conduct process under the current code and procedures. This slide depicts a snapshot of the entire process of the procedures. The top boxes reflect the initial assessment of reports, while the bottom section inside the bolded red box are the possible resolution methods under the procedures. Let's zoom in for a better understanding, starting first with the initial assessment. The initial assessment starts when an incident report is submitted to and received by the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, followed by the review and assessment of the incident report by staff in that office. From there, there are several potential courses of action. First, no action is taken in situations where the behavior reported is not a violation of the code or there is no respondent identified. Another option is that the report could be referred to a different office. If the report does not rise to the level of a conduct violation, or if the report is required to be addressed by a different office, it will be referred elsewhere. For example, if the report alleges sexual misconduct, it would be referred to the Cornell Office of Civil Rights. If the report involves a Greek life recruitment violation that did not allege alcohol, hazing, or other prohibited conduct under the code, it would be referred to sorority and fraternity life. If it was a minor infraction of residence hall policies that didn't meet the threshold for the code, it would be referred to housing and residence life. For some cases, interim action is taken. The procedures permit the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards to put in place a range of interim actions, which can include restrictions up to and including full temporary suspensions. Full temporary suspensions broadly prohibit the student from being on campus and from continuing academically. Other forms of temporary suspension allow limited access to campus and the ability to continue academically. Temporary suspension is imposed only when immediate action is necessary to protect the complainant or the university community. All forms of temporary suspension can be appealed to the Vice President for Student and Campus Life, or a designee. An additional level of appeal to the provost of the university is available when a full temporary suspension impacts a student's academic continuity. The Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards also completes an ongoing assessment of whether or not the interim action remains necessary and can modify interim actions at any time as appropriate. The initial assessment is also when an intake meeting is held with both the complainant and the respondent, collectively known as the parties. The current code and procedures outlines the role of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards to resolve complaints between parties. A complainant can be either an individual who is personally impacted by the behavior reported or a designated complainant. A designated complainant is typically an individual that represents a university department that encountered the alleged violation. The most frequent examples of designated complainants are sorority and fraternity life, housing and residence life, or the Cornell University Police Department. The respondent can be either an individual student or a registered or recognized student organization. If the respondent is a student organization, the president of that organization serves as the representative of the student organization for the purpose of the conduct process. Once we have a complainant and a respondent and the intake has occurred, we move into the resolution process. Let's look now at the possible resolution options under the current procedures. Based on the party's intake, there are three possible ways to resolve the reports that come in. One method of resolution is non-conduct resolution. These are cases that have no outcome of responsibility. Examples of reports that result in non-conduct resolutions include applying the Good Samaritan Protocol, which is a Cornell policy that encourages others to call for help when a student needs assistance from consuming alcohol and other drugs, In non-conduct resolutions, educational conversations around the intent of behavior versus the impact of behavior or warning letters for particular minor offenses, such as possessing a forged identification card or very minor theft at the Cornell bookstore. Another potential pathway is alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. Wherever possible, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards tries to explore ADR. ADR is how the majority of conduct cases are resolved. It's important to note that an ADR resolution is completely voluntary and requires both parties to agree to this pathway. This means one party cannot insist on ADR if the other does not want to do it. Therefore, if there is not agreement about pursuing ADR, the matter will be resolved through the third option, a formal complaint. If ADR is mutually agreed upon, there are many possible avenues, including mediation, a restorative justice conference, or others. The ADR options incorporate varying degrees of restorative practices. Another important note is that ADR resolutions are all agreement-based, meaning both parties have to agree on the outcome. If an ADR resolution cannot be reached, the conduct case must then be resolved through the formal complaint process. Overall, the ADR process is the most restorative and the most collaborative way to resolve a conduct case. The third and final option to resolve a complaint is the formal complaint pathway, which involves a full investigation. This is also the resolution method that takes the longest amount of time. There are three ways that a formal complaint can be resolved. First, a formal complaint can be dismissed by the director of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. Examples of a dismissal is when the alleged behavior is not corroborated and therefore there is no violation of the code, or when there's a non-responsive complainant. If the director does dismiss the complainant's formal complaint, the complainant can request a hearing panel to review this decision. The hearing panel can uphold the director's dismissal or reinstate the formal complaint. You'll learn more about the hearing panel process shortly. The formal complaint can also be resolved via alternate resolution, which is not to be confused with alternative dispute resolution mentioned previously. An alternate resolution in the formal complaint process is a negotiated agreement between the complainant and the respondent, and is the most common resolution under the formal complaint pathway. As was the case for alternative dispute resolutions, both parties have to agree to participate in the process, and the ultimate outcome of alternate resolutions. The procedures currently require that all investigations be paused during the alternate resolution process, so that does lengthen the investigation timeline and the total time to resolution. Finally, a formal complaint can be resolved via a hearing. The hearing panel pool is comprised of 55 students, staff, and faculty members within the Cornell community. Five of these individuals are selected from the hearing panel pool to convene for each hearing. The hearing panel reviews the investigative record and report, determines whether the respondent violated the code, and determines the appropriate sanctions, if applicable. The Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards has no influence in the decision made by the hearing panel. A hearing panel decision can be appealed to a three-person review panel. The review panel is selected from the aforementioned hearing panel pool. Again, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards has no influence in the decision made by the review panel. Thank you for your interest in the Code of Conduct and Procedures. To learn more or to view copies of the 2020 Code of Conduct and Associated Procedures, please visit scl.cornell.edu or use the QR codes provided. Thank you.
So at this point, we'd like to turn it over to Wendy to call on people for questions. And you may see Stephanie and I looking around at our screens. We're taking diligent notes so that we can best, you know, relay the thoughts that you bring to us today. But with that, we'd love for your feedback.
Great. Thanks, Nick. So yes, if anyone has any questions or comments to share with Stephanie and Nick, please raise your hand. I'll start a speaker list. We have plenty of time. We have about 55 minutes. I will, you know, depending on the speaker list, we may limit the time, but any thoughts, comments, questions? I'll actually start. So As a staff member who does engage with students on a somewhat regular basis, how do you see this impacting the staff community at Cornell? Are you just taking that question to bring back to the committee and then you'll let us know, or?
Yes, thank you so much. We both are we're taking notes in our Google Doc. Yeah, so we are unable to answer questions. We can answer clarifying questions about the process, but we are taking notes and questions back to the team. But that actually might be a good question to pose to the entire group of how do you all see the student code revisions and the student code of conduct impacting the work that you do as well. Does that help clarify, Wendy?
Yes, that does.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about the awkward radio silence.
No, it's fine. Yes, Alyssa, and then Michael.
Are you able to clarify which parts of this are being changed? What are the new parts?
So, Nick can I'll leave it to you to answer this one.
Oh, sure. So at this time, there's no recommendation that's been put forward by the committee. This committee's work started with going out into the community, into the various constituencies of Cornell, Employee Assembly, Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, Student Assembly, the Faculty Senate, to solicit feedback. There is no proposal on the table at this time.
Understood. Thank you.
Michael?
So is the follow-up on the last question, is this policy already in place? Because it was the last question, because we were trying to figure out what the revisions would be.
Yeah,
Or
so taken as a whole, the code is being looked at for revision. So when it was created years ago, the process was removed from the independent group to the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. And at this point, they're looking at all of the areas of the code that might need to be adapted. So it's taken as a whole and then narrowed down. But as a committee, we don't necessarily look at the code and say, we want to adapt this section of the code, and this is what we think it should be. It's more of we're looking at the listening sessions to see the pain points, to see what might be an opportunity to revise. Does that help with clarity, Michael?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to make mine more of a statement than a question. I th think what I like about it is that it's they have a mediation process and it's not punitive from the get-go. So that if something really bad does happen, yeah, maybe it goes through the police or somebody like that. But that if somebody, these are young people, and if they make a mistake, to give them an opportunity to correct what that is, if with this mediation process. That it sounds like it escalates. So I kind of like that if we're not like I say being punitive with somebody from the get-go, but also to get keep some civility in our population as well.
And Jeremy.
So having been being an old guy who's been very much involved with the code of conduct since, oh, maybe 2018, I've seen the revisions come through, and I think this is a definite step in the right direction. I agree with Michael. Having a transparent, defined process really adds trust, so I'm appreciative of that. I do want to call out, sort of towards Wendy's question, that staff are intimately involved with this process from the very beginning, observing or reporting code violations of the code, right through to the end as part of the board. So I would love to see, and maybe it already exists, more detail on how the staff is involved, what the expectations are of individual staff members. They observe or think they observe or have reported to them violations or potential violations of the code, and what their process is. Also, in addition to that, I'd like to see more communication about ways for staff to be involved in the process after reporting. So I've sat on the board, appeals board before. I'm sure that process has changed since then, but I'd like to continue to advertise to staff ways that we can stay involved in this process.
Well said, Jeremy. Thank you for putting what I blurted out so eloquently. That's actually kind of what I was looking for as well. Do we have anyone else with any comments or feedback for our facilitators? Please don't be shy. This is a good opportunity for us to have a voice at the table as staff with this process to give them some feedback. Yes, Alyssa.
I understand that staff have their own requirements, but since it's very clearly does not apply to staff or professors, does it make more sense to have general standards for the Cornell community so the students feel like we're being held to the same standards? Because I would also be distressed if there was underage staff drinking or things like that.
Alyssa, if I can ask a clarifying question, is your potential proposal to have kind of some set standards across the board for faculty, staff, and students, considering the staff is not a part of the student code of conduct?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Also, just for clarification, we are taking feedback and comments from non-EA members. So if you have any feedback or anything you'd like to share with the committee members, please feel free to raise your hand and I will add you to the speaker list. Yes, Jeremy.
So I just wanted to clarify from my understanding that we do have similar expectations there through the HR office, but I absolutely agree that having publicly somewhere a document that shows parity so that we can be seen as part of the community, all adhering to similar rule sets, would be valuable.
Anyone else with any comments or feedback, please feel free to raise your hand. I've got the speaker list going. I'll add one other comment or feedback. As far as the composition of this committee, and actually other committees, university-wide committees, as far as staff representation, it would be helpful to know who's chosen to be on these committees. Especially, you know, with this, I believe there's three staff members, and they're all, actually, I take that back, there's three staff members and then Vice President Ryan Lombardi, who's ex officio. But for the staff members, it looks like it was individuals that are directly involved with this process. And it may have been helpful or not to have kind of an outsider's view, like perhaps someone from the employee assembly or another, constituent, like kind of give a different perspective rather than someone who really is involved in these processes on a day-to-day basis. Yes, Jeremy.
So I think that was the thought process behind originally having the code administered by the university assembly. I completely understand why it is no longer, and I think there's been some great advancements since that time. But I think revisiting the question of representation is important with this new system.
Thanks, Jeremy. Anyone else? Again, if you're not an EA member, you're more than welcome to provide some feedback or comments to Stephanie and Nicholas to bring back to the committee. Please feel free to raise your hand. Yes, Alyssa.
Things keep coming to me, Wendy.
That's fine.
Is there opportunity here to put into place some things in the student code of conduct about best practices in order to keep other students who might be international students who might be in more vulnerable, precarious situations safe? Overall expectations for interactions with illegal things that might be going on campus from a federal perspective. And I know we've sort of spoken out on it before, but as things keep getting messier and messier, having something written in stone in our student code of conduct of how we would expect our students to react in impossible situations would be, I think, appropriate to be talking about at this time.
Can I ask a follow-up, Alyssa? Being on the topic of keeping vulnerable communities safe here at Cornell, are you thinking along the lines of when people who are not directly members of the Cornell community, how their behavior interacts with the handbook? So, for example, somebody from outside, if they were to come to Cornell's campus, is that, I want to make sure I'm understanding your question, or is it more like a handbook for how to engage in certain situations safely as a staff member?
No, I'm saying what we would expect in the event, again, I'm just gonna say what I mean at this point, but in the event that ICE were on campus, what are the expectations for our students? Would the expectation be that they again move more vulnerable populations to the back, or is this the would Are the expectations that they open doors? Are the expectations that they close doors and say, show me a warrant? Because I think at
Thank
the,
you. That's
like,
helpful.
yeah, that's, again, conversations that we need to be talking about is how far the university would go to support students in those actions, and not just that, but what the expectation of a Cornell student is, if there would be illegal federal agents on our campus.
Alyssa, I think to that point, there has been extensive information provided on the Office of Global Learning's website of how students and staff can should be reacting should an ICE agent appear on campus or try to detain someone. I think that might be a better place to get the answer, at least to that particular question. I don't know that it really has too many tie-ins with the revision, this campus code, the student code of conduct review and revision process, if that's helpful. We'll go to Allison and then to Jeremy again.
Okay, so I'm not sure if this is in scope, obviously, but I wonder if there might be an opportunity here to look at any sort of consent standards when it comes to using AI in certain kinds of interactions, for people's privacy and things like that. So Obviously, we, yeah, there's stuff like using AI for meeting notes and I don't know, classroom stuff that could potentially impact staff and faculty, but also just students with each other, honestly. I wonder if there's an opportunity here to look at establishing some guidelines or standards or rules about that or yeah. To me, in my view on it is, you know, to respect each other's privacy and ability to opt in or whatever. That's how I would see it.
Great. Thanks for that, Allison. Jeremy?
Yeah, just to tack on to what you said, Wendy. There's been good communication about response to outside enforcement on campus. I think the short answer, though, you should go look it up yourself. The short answer is contact CUPD. They are well informed on how they're supposed to be handling things. The memory serves, the statement is that we will follow the law and not to interfere. So that's, I think, the current statement, but go look it up for yourself. On the AI topic, I think that's a really good idea for this committee to be thinking about in the code, since this is kind of new development. At least it's become increasingly popular over the last year. And pushed by the university itself, with issues like using AI to produce images of folks in compromising situations, producing nudes of folks, which is not technically illegal at this time. I think we should be considering in our code of conduct being explicit about what is and isn't allowed in our community.
Great. Thanks, Jeremy. Anyone else, please feel free to raise your hand to be called upon. Yes, Melina. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. The question I have to extend the comment a little bit that Alicia made, that I worry about with the code of conduct is that, and I think we just saw this over the past couple of years, there were perhaps unintended consequences of applying the code of conduct for international students in particular, because it essentially put them in the eye of an unfriendly federal government and kind of took the conduct question out of the hands of the university. So this is just my opinion, but I wish that the code of conduct would just be an internal matter, you know, but it basically, the fallout for I don't know. My perception of the code of conduct is that the way in which it has changed makes it more punitive, with higher consequences for students than whatever was happening in the past. And so I appreciate the presentation. This isn't a forum where we can ask questions and have them be answered, which is weird. So I don't know. And it's also just, you know, why are we getting this presentation now instead of when it came out in 2020? It's like 6 years later. I missed the beginning of the presentation, so there may have been some context about that, but those are just a few thoughts that I have. Thank you.
So Melina, you'll see I just actually put in the chat the Student Code of Conduct Review and Revision Process, their website. It details like why are we doing this and the history of it and that sort of thing. There was a video that they presented. It's about an 11-minute video or so. It kind of explains the process itself currently, and then also the timeline and who's on the code and procedures review committee. So that might be helpful in answering some of your questions. So This is it is a unique meeting in that it's a special meeting and it is really just a listening session. It's not for asking or looking to have any questions answered or anything like that, but just really providing feedback and comments for both Nicholas and Stephanie to bring back to the rest of the committee to help in framing and shaping. They're on their speaking tour right now. As they mentioned, they have gone to other assemblies, the student assembly, the grad professional student assembly, the university assembly. They haven't gone to yet. They will be in next week, and faculty senate. So they're reaching out to all of the shared governance branches just to, again, to kind of pick people's brains, get some feedback, get some comments. Hey, maybe this would be a good thing to add in. I have some concerns about XYZ, whatever it might be. But again, so we do appreciate everyone taking their time to join us with us today. Jeremy.
Just want to say that while communication may or may not have been what it should have been in 2020, my perception of what we're seeing right now is the very earliest engagement, where the reason this is a weird meeting, I think, is because no changes have been proposed or made yet. We're ahead of that. So I think they actually are engaging us at the very start of this one, which I think is an improvement over last time.
Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah, if I could actually provide, thank you, Jeremy, for that. This is definitely kind of at the beginning of the process, although we have been meeting to make some grammatical changes, some clarity edits, but major addition revisions of the code have not yet been put in front of us. So a lot of this stuff has been fairly minor, and you're right, this listening session. Well, it does feel awkward and weird that we, as Nick and I, we like to believe we know the process fairly well. Neither one of us were here when this process was created, so it really again shows those gaps in information. I think some of these, all of the feedback that we've gotten is actually very helpful for the committee. So, although it feels a little awkward, we are getting some good nuggets. So, hopefully that helps a little bit.
Yes, Allison.
And I apologize if I missed this during the presentation. This might be, and maybe you can't answer it all, Nick, but is the, since you said you're a grad student, is the grad student union involved in this process directly, or is it just through representation? I don't know. Yeah. Can you answer a question like that or no?
To the extent of a member on the committee, there is not a designated union representative at this time, though there are multiple graduate students.
Thank you. I guess my feedback might be to consider that, I guess, or at least to talk about it. Maybe you all have already talked about it actually with the union and made a decision amongst yourselves, in which case, do what feels right. But if not, I guess I would recommend that.
I have a clarifying comment, I guess, either for Stephanie or Nick. Based on the timeline, it does look during the months of February, March, that there will be some draft revisions, invitation for Cornell community members to engage in public commenting, and then additional listening sessions as needed. Can you just confirm, maybe how that process might look for the public commenting part, or clarify that?
Oh, Stephanie,
No,
did you
go
want to
ahead.
take this one?
Go ahead. Go
Oh,
ahead.
sure. So the model is at the next stage of this process is going to be similar to the expressive activity policy, where once there are draft changes that are proposed, they'll be circulated throughout the Cornell community. The assemblies will have an opportunity to respond in writing or by resolution, and those comments will be funneled back to the committee, is my understanding of the current plan.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Kyle.
Hey everyone, thanks again for the presentation and just bringing this to our attention. I guess I just wanted to have this comment on the record. I'm not sure how much y'all can do with this, but when I like hear code of conduct, I think about like what is a rule that students must follow or else there will be some kind of a punitive measure taken against them. I just want to put it out there that, it's almost like the fewer rules and the more resources, the better, the more opportunities that something can be read as requiring punitive action in response to student behavior. I just feel like the worst outcome there will be. The university is a place and a space for students to learn and to grow, and not necessarily to always have, punitive measures taken against them for some kind of action that they take. Obviously, there's limits to that. There's certain behaviors that they should know better. I understand that, but just when someone brought up the point about, what are students supposed to do in the event that ICE shows up or a federal agent shows up at their doorsteps, that would be a case, I think, where providing resources is the most helpful step to take, as opposed to just creating more rules that students are inevitably not going to know all of the rules that the university can just, use as a chance to punish them. That's something I think should be avoided.
Great. Thanks for that, Kyle. Anyone else? We still have 28 minutes. So, Stephanie and Nick, if we have someone that comes back to us either after this meeting or perhaps an EA member who didn't join the meeting and went to that website and had some questions or just the comments or feedback, where would we send that information to? Or who would we send that information to? Is it the code and procedure at cornell.edu email?
That's exactly right. I was actually about to type it in the chat. Yes, we have an
Okay.
email inbox for that.
I will put it in chat so that people are aware of that.
Yeah, we both were scanning the our documents, but yeah, code,
I have
whatever
the website, I have the
it is.
page open just for my own reference because it's how my brain is working, my non-caffeinated brain this morning, unfortunately. Anyone else have any comments, feedback? Yes, Jeremy.
Just for you, Wendy, as I am currently unable to take notes, could you send out that information to the list?
I certainly will. Thank you
Thank you.
for that suggestion. I will let the EA members know of the page and the email and to please share with their constituents. If no one has any other feedback or comments to provide to Stephanie or Nicholas, I am happy to give everyone 25 minutes of their afternoon back and would call for an adjourn of motion to adjourn by unanimous consent.
I move that we adjourn by unanimous consent.
Do I have a second?
Seconded.
Thank you, Alyssa. Do I have any dissent? Seeing no dissent, again, please feel free, go to the website, review that. If you have any questions about the process or feedback to provide to the committee, please use that email. And with that said, I am adjourning this meeting at 12:50 p.m. on Monday, January 26th, 2026. Thank you all for joining us. I appreciate it. Thanks again, Stephanie and Nick.